People say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Tennessee Ernie Ford sang about the company store, a feature of the company town where workers spent their salaries before they collected them, finding themselves effectively in an indentured servitude. But how close was that to the reality of Lowell, Massachusetts, Gary, Indiana, Hershey, Pennsylvania, or Corning, New York? All of them were company towns, each built by a single corporation. Actually, some 2,500 company towns once dotted the United States, often paternalistic and at times even utopian. Hardy Green, a former associate editor at Businessweek, has written, "The Company Town, the Industrial Edens and Satanic Mills that Shaped the American Economy." It's published by Basic Books, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Lowell, Massachusetts was the first large-scale planned industrial community. What company founded it?
Well, it was founded by what came to be known as the Boston Associates, a group of capitalists who were actually sort of intermarried. And it was a slowly expanding group of capitalists. There were a number of companies there. The Merrimack Company was one of the first. They had a variety of names like this. There was the Boot Company. But in fact, they all had sort of interlocking directorates and had very common policies.
It was called the Boot Company because Kirk Boot was one of the people in charge.
Right. Kirk and his brother both were investors in these companies.
And in this case, they were using the waterfalls on the Merrimack River to power the mills?
Exactly. Think of mills as being associated initially with coal, and there was a lot of coal in America, but not very accessible to where these factories were first built in the early 19th century. So,
They were greener than most of our factories are today.
They were, right. The hydraulics at Lowell became a major innovation and a kind of intellectual property that they were then able to export elsewhere.
And this, they made initially printed calico. Was that a really profitable business?
It was. The kind of cloth that these people, these capitalists built, made first in Waltham, their first industrial settlement was in Waltham, Massachusetts, was a simpler kind of cloth. And these printed calicos were a more sophisticated cloth.
So would Lowell, Massachusetts even be known to us if not for the Merrimack Company and the other companies that were part of it?
Well, it was really created for that purpose. In the 1820s, this group of capitalists, including Nathan Appleton, went there and sort of scouted out the area, and there was almost nothing there. It was a little agricultural community, and they, in time, built it into this major industrial complex.
And did they draw their workers from the agricultural community?
They did. They sent initially, through the 19th century, there was kind of a labor shortage in America, and we're talking about the early days of industrialization, but they sent recruiting agents into Vermont and New Hampshire to try and recruit mostly young women to work in Lowell initially.
We were talking about the early 1800s. Was there much immigration at that time?
No. The waves of immigration to America really came later.
So what happened? You had these girls working in these plants at a time when women generally didn't go to work. Was it a class thing? Were poor girls more likely to be acceptable as workers?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think that the overlords at Lowell went out of their way to make it seem like it would be an uplifting and almost middle-class experience, somewhat like going to college, where they would live in boarding houses, that it would all be overseen by older women who would make sure there was a kind of in loco parentis policy, no drinking, no dancing, and a kind of moral policing that was partly enforced by the girls themselves.
So how did they even meet people so they could get married?
Well, not in Lowell, I think. Not mostly in Lowell. I think that many of them regarded this as a kind of period of kind of recess from normal life.
Was this a pleasant thing, or was it a hard chore to work at these factories.
It was hard, and you see in something like the Lowell Offering, this magazine that was written for and published by the young women, a kind of mixed feelings. You can see these essays that they wrote. There's a kind of feeling that this is, you know, awful. It's so different from living with my parents on the farm. I have to wake up at 4:30 in the morning and work until 7 at night. They had mixed feelings about the whole experience.
Well, there were labor actions in the 1830s. But really the major change occurred during the Civil War.
Right, just before and during the Civil War.
That's because cotton no longer was coming up north?
Well, it's also because of the immigration, because, first of all, I think it was they were finding it harder and harder to find a total workforce from this crowd of young women, young farm women. But there also were was the Irish immigration and waves of immigrants from Europe who came looking for industrial labor.
When were unions formed in Lowell?
There was activity, you know, as early as the 1830s. But most of the union activity was later on, and we're, I think, familiar with these textile strikes that happened in the first part of the 20th century in Lowell and Lawrence.
What's Lowell like now?
Lowell, you know, is now, it's actually kind of nice. It is a national park. It is a place that's very interesting to go to and see these still, you know, they built these mills to last. And so some of them are now condominiums overlooking the Merrimack River. Others are this Lowell National Park where you can go in and they have mills running, they have looms running, and you can experience just how loud the textile mill really is. So it's a kind of educational experience. There are a number of museums there that are devoted to textiles.
But it had been run by a family. What happened to the family?
You mean it's more than one family, but yeah. The Boston Associates, well, they kind of drifted into other interests, for one thing. I mean, one of the things that went on in the textile industry, now bear in mind that textiles is one of the first things that a developing industrial economy will go into. But they allowed the mills in Lowell to kind of become technologically obsolete. And the newer mills that were built in the South after the Civil War had more modern equipment. So the Boston
and less labor strife.
They had labor strife, too. They had plenty, you know. But it's true, not initially.
Another company town is Hershey, Pennsylvania. Its founder was William Hershey. How did he wind up in the chocolate business?
Milton Hershey, actually. Milton had been in the he had sold candies in New York City. He had been in the caramel business, and he went to the Chicago Exposition at the end of the 19th century and saw these chocolate machines. Now, chocolate at that point was regarded as a luxury product, a European luxury product, and he understood that this could become a mass food, and so he sold his caramel business, went into the chocolate business, created the town of Hershey, Pennsylvania, located in an area where he was born, actually, and close to the dairy farms, since this would be milk chocolate. One of the main products he needed would be the milk.
Didn't he see this as a utopian community?
He did.
Well, how utopian was it? Did he pay his workers like a true utopian might?
I mean, to begin with, one of the things that was really different in Hershey from, let's say, the textile towns or the mining towns was the housing itself, which was very nice, indoor plumbing, electricity, central heating. But they, an earlier town like Pullman, Illinois, there were public institutions, libraries, and, playing fields, the landscaping by the country. There was a company. There were no taxes. And if you got a job working in Hershey, you got pensions, life insurance, medical benefits. So all of these kinds of things that now seem pretty modern were available in Hershey.
And what happened when the unions came along?
Well, there was one incident that was extremely kind of damaging to all concerned, where there was a sit-down strike in the Hershey chocolate plant in the 1930s, and the farmers who depended upon selling their milk to Hershey came in and beat up the strikers. So they were afraid that this union was going to be, you know, was going to kill the golden goose. But I think there has been, a union there, sort of a conservative AFL-type union for years.
But isn't Hershey's moving part of its operation abroad?
They have been gradually outsourcing their chocolate production to Asia, to other parts of the country. And they just recently announced that they're closing the historic chocolate plant that's sort of at the center of this town. It's on Chocolate Avenue. It's the reason why when you walk through downtown Hershey, you can smell chocolate in the air. They're closing this. They're going to have another plant that's sort of on the outskirts of town, but that'll only employ a few hundred workers, I believe.
So what happens to a town when the company picks up and leaves? We saw it in Lowell. Now it's a park. Hershey's going to become another park?
It already is.
Well, they have a park there, but the Hershey's created that park.
Hershey, the town, is like a number of these places, has become a tourist destination. Another place that's like that is Kohler, Wisconsin, which is where the Kohler Plumbing Fixtures Company still has productive facilities, but also they have golf courses, they have spas, they have if you look at the Kohler website, you see that it's offered as a tourist destination. So a number of places have made accommodations to the present by moving more into the tourist economy, but that's certainly can't be done in Gary, Indiana, or Newton, Iowa, the former home of the Maytag company. I think they have a more difficult transition.
My guest is Hardy Green, whose book, The Company Town, The Industrial Edens and Satanic Mills That Shaped the American Economy, is published by Basic Books. Are company towns an American phenomenon?
Not at all. I mean, they really are all over the world. Become aware recently that there's a large project in Iran. There's also a famous town in India, Jamshedpur, which was built by the Tata Steel Company and still run by the Tata Steel Company. But America, having been this sort of virgin land, an area that was open for exploitation or development, has been, I think, very accommodating to company towns.
And in your book, you talk about company towns as being both a positive and a negative development. Exploitation is a negative development, and that's what we saw in most of the mining towns?
Right. I mean, I think that the coal mining towns are quite, clearly kind of a negative experience.
Why couldn't they have been owned by utopian types like Milton Hershey?
I don't know. It seems to vary a lot from industry to industry, and it does seem to be the case that the coal towns are some of the worst places, and both in terms of the way that workers were treated, they're paid in company's scrip, they're expected to buy everything at the company store, to live in company housing. So it's kind of a total institution in a lot of the coal towns, and some steel towns are rather like this as well. But it seems to vary a lot from industry to industry.
Well, Tennessee Ernie Ford sang that song, what was that, in the 50s or 60s? But are they still like that? After all, the United Mine Workers came in. How much were they able to change this negative environment?
Well, let's say that really a lot of the conflict that we're familiar with in Harlan, Kentucky, for example, demonstrated that these companies were viciously anti-union and would do sort of anything. And the only way that the United Mine Workers was able to get into some of these places was very similar to the way that the civil rights movement operated, that they had to have federal marshals come and, supervise, because otherwise the union organizers were in danger of being killed.
Who is Gary, Indiana named after?
Gary, Indiana is named after Judge Gary, the head of United States Steel, and he basically created gave orders that this town should be created in 1906.
Why there? It was a combination of combinations?
Yes.
As they said?
United States Steel had only recently been created by J.P. Morgan and others as this world's largest steel company. And yet they found that very shortly after their creation that they were losing market share to some of the smaller companies and that they needed more resources. So they had a big works in South Chicago, and they thought about building more in Chicago, but nothing really seemed to be – they didn't seem to have quite enough land. And they realized that right across the border on the Lake Michigan shore, right across in Indiana, there was this area that they could where they could build.
Well, how is this any different from what happened in Pittsburgh or in Bessemer?
It's I think it, the creation of Gary was much more. It didn't happen slowly. It happened much more sort of instantaneous. In fact,
as a company town.
Yes, it was called the Magic City by some observers because it just came into being very, very quickly.
Judge Gary resisted giving his workers Sundays off. When did he finally come around on that one?
Not until the 1920s. I mean, the working day in America is really it's an interesting topic. Back in Lowell in the 1840s, these young women were working 7 days a week, 12-hour days. Actually, I think they worked only 6 days a week there. And in the steel industry, until 1923, there was the 12-hour day and the 7-day week.
And the 8-hour day was one of the leading goals of the unions, wasn't it, in the
early
days?
It's true. And social reformers as well. I think that the social reformers that criticized United States Steel for its continuing to insist on this 12-hour day were influential as well in getting the reform.
Well, steel has pretty much disappeared from the American economy. So what is Gary like now?
You know, Gary for years has really been a kind of an urban nightmare. U.S. Steel didn't really put that much into the town. They kind of the steel industry had this attitude that a lot of the towns should just develop themselves. And so U.S. Steel ended up building some residential dwellings in Gary. And as one observer put it, they built half a town. But it's since, the 1950s and 60s really been a very depressed environment.
Pittsburgh has worked very hard to turn itself around.
Right. Pittsburgh is beautiful now.
We have new company towns, don't we? For example, Redmond, Washington, the Microsoft company town?
Well, one of the things that happened is starting in about the 1940s, a number of companies decided that they didn't want to be in urban environments. So one of the first to do this was Bell Labs, which was thinking in the 1930s of building a new headquarters in New York City and decided instead to build a company campus near Summit, New Jersey. And they were followed by PepsiCo and IBM. And pretty soon by the 1960s, this move to corporate campuses became a major thrust of company development.
But they weren't new cities.
They were not new cities. They were mostly, but they were almost, they were city-like in that almost everything that you would ever want was there. So that the Googleplex is sort of Google's facility in Mountain View, California, is kind of apotheosis of this, where everything you would ever want is available there, from nap rooms to free food to massages to any kind of, you know, croquet or games that you might like to play.
Were they aware of the earlier histories? Were they, in developing these new places, trying to avoid the problems that arose in the earlier company towns?
I'm not sure that a place like Google would have been thinking about what happened in Pullman, Illinois. But as the towns were built, they were certainly always aware of what had gone on before. And in Gary, Indiana, they were very much aware of what had happened in Pullman.
I mentioned earlier that you used to be a book review editor at Business Week.
Correct.
I don't know how that works in with your PhD in history and your teaching of American history at Stony Brook and the School of Visual Arts.
Right. I taught history and political science at the School of Visual Arts, where art majors have to take a certain number of humanities courses.
How did this all fit together? Were you only reviewing books on history at Business?
No. I was actually – that was the editor, the book review editor. So I didn't do all the reviews. I was sort of farming them out to people.
And now you have a blog.
I have a blog. That's right.
Writing about company towns, I imagine.
I write about all kinds of things. I write about other business books, but I've also written about some recent developments in company towns.
Your subtitle is Industrial Edens and Satanic Mills. Do we still have any Industrial Edens or Satanic Mills?
Well, maybe I mentioned before, but Corning is sort of an Industrial Eden. I mean, here's a company that's done a whole lot for this town. And
glass continues to be something that people want to buy.
They've had a very up and down kind of experience. They for a number of years they were very involved with fiber optic cable, and that there was kind of overproduction in that regard. And now I think what they do a lot of are these sort of screens for these BlackBerry-like devices.
So they've expanded beyond making vases and, nice wine glasses.
Well, I think from the very beginning in Corning, they were not they might have been making bottles or windows, but they didn't. They, from the very beginning, they one of the first products they made were light bulbs. They were commissioned by the Edison Company to make light bulbs, which were, for many years, hand-blown.
Hardy Green's book, The Company Town, The Industrial Edens and Satanic Mills That Shaped the American Economy, is published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.